I'm Dan Jaffe for The Old Mole. On September 30th, Donald Trump announced that the U.S., Mexico, and Canadian governments had agreed on the text of a renegotiated NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. Many will remember that NAFTA was passed back in 1993, pushed by Bill Clinton, in spite of adamant opposition from organized labor and environmental groups who predicted it would lead to job losses, falling wages, threaten national sovereignty. And NAFTA has removed tariffs, it has linked the three economies much more closely, it has deregulated trade, and it's increased the rights for corporations and investors. Now, 24 years later, NAFTA has suddenly been torn up and redone. What's in this new plan and what are the implications? And to help sort that out, my guest, Russell Lum, is the Trade Justice Coordinator of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, a coalition of labor, environmental, and human rights groups that advocates on trade policy issues. Welcome, Russell.
Thank you, Dan. Pleased to be here.
So let's start out briefly. What has been the legacy of NAFTA after 24 years? What has been the impact in Mexico, in the U.S., and maybe here in Oregon in particular? And how does that contrast with the promises that were made back when Clinton signed the deal?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the critical question is if we're taking this approach to NAFTA and if we're demanding an alternative to NAFTA, really, what's the big grievance? Well, I sometimes don't know whether to sort it out as broken promises from the way NAFTA was sold or simply outright deceptions from a NAFTA model that free trade-minded people who run the global economy, who are neoclassical economics influenced, and who have the sway of most of the governments of the world, whether these were merely their intents. But certainly one of the intents was to turn Mexico into an export engine for the global north countries. And this entailed, hand in hand with agricultural subsidies and agribusiness favorable policies to United States interests, it entailed uprooting folks from their agrarian livelihoods in Mexico and sort of driving them to an export-driven and assembly-driven Mexican economy that put people in sweatshops, that put people in highly, highly exploitive labor conditions in the maquiladora economy. So Mexico is, and Mexico, I think, partly in NAFTA's origins, was designed to be kind of this low-wage labor sink for other countries. We have seen that. Contrary to maybe promises that this would develop Mexico and maybe increase wages with that kind of development word being used, contrary to the increase in Mexican wages, the average Mexican worker is making 9% less than they were in 1993. That's sort of how we characterize it in terms of Mexico, an uprooting of local livelihoods, a worsened economic opportunity and economic gain for normal Mexican folks. And in our country, job loss. The deindustrialization pattern of the last 30 years was accelerated by NAFTA. NAFTA was designed to help, like I say, accelerated in the sense that the U.S. wasn't producing its own stuff. The U.S. was relying on Mexico and repeating this pattern for other countries, right, south of Mexico and on down, to have those low-wage countries produce stuff.
And how about here in Oregon? I know that ORFTC has worked a lot on the impact of NAFTA right here and job loss here in Oregon. What are the statistics for Oregon?
Yeah, Oregon has seen the same effects of the NAFTA era being hard on the pocketbook of regular people. So Oregon's richest 10% now capture over 46% of the state's income, whereas they captured 39% of the state's income prior to NAFTA. So there's sort of the broad picture about wealth being sucked from working class folks and from middle class folks to the top. But we've seen 12,000 manufacturing jobs in Oregon lost due to NAFTA. We've seen more than 68,000 jobs across the economy, lost directly due to trade policy in the NAFTA era. And a lot of these are, let's say, a wealth of pulp and paper producing jobs, metals manufacturing jobs, vehicle manufacturing jobs, telecom. Those, say, unions that have seen their brother and sister union members lose their jobs, that have seen their factories shutter, that have seen work stoppages. That's some of the fuel that we run on in Oregon Fair Trade Campaign to talk about that side of the story for us here in Oregon.
Well, let's talk specifically about what is new in Trump's NAFTA 2.0, which they are calling the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA. How much is new? What's new? And how much is the same old NAFTA?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and kind of a long answer in the respect that there are some things in this new NAFTA which we're expecting to be signed later this month, and which will go forth to the respective legislatures of the signing governments early next year. We are seeing some things which are better. We're seeing some things in trade agreements that we've long demanded. However, in a larger package that doesn't change the failed trade model that we've been identifying all these years. It's not a good agreement in that respect. It's got some improvements, but in a larger package that continues, you know, the loss of jobs, that continues the depression of wages, that continues a disrespect of human rights and migrant rights, and it continues the legacy of environmental damage. So if those things aren't transformed, groups like ours are going to say, well, we're not seeing enough. Here are the things that progressive groups, that labor groups, that environmental groups, that climate-minded groups have been saying about trade policy for 15 years, for 25 years. Where are the results in the new NAFTA? The record's mixed, but we're not sold. And so that having been said, when this comes down to being a fight in the U.S. Congress, it means asking members of Congress to hold the line on these things which we're holding the line on, and we're going to contend in the arena of where this agreement's going to get approved, like Congress, saying, you know, show us the results for how working people are going to benefit, including that working people are going to get their rights enforced in this agreement. One of the things that's supposedly better about NAFTA is the workers' rights component. But only if it's enforced or it's not worth the paper that it's written on.
Well, let's get a little more into those nuts and bolts, because I have a sort of a document here from one of the national groups that you work with, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and it's full of red X's and green check marks. And the green check marks are sort of things that trade justice activists have been asking for all along. And it's a real mix of reds and green. What are some of the positives here? Things that labor has actually been demanding over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, probably the most important thing that this new NAFTA improves upon is it nearly ends ISDS. And by that we mean investor-state dispute settlement, the provision which NAFTA championed. NAFTA was the first major trade agreement to have it, and it being the provision that says corporations can sue governments. And it's not reciprocal. Governments can't sue corporations, and certainly workers can't sue corporations. But this is the feature of NAFTA and later trade agreements, that corporations can sue governments when they make grievance that some government act, usually a regulation in the public interest or a law in the public interest, interrupted their expectation of profit. We are seeing a new NAFTA which has almost removed ISDS with a loophole, with a carve-in for oil and gas industry, which we find unacceptable. But it is groundbreaking that the new NAFTA, especially because we've known that NAFTA has sort of been a blueprint for later trade agreements and later trade policy. So we'd love to see a diminished or removed ISDS as the blueprint for later trade agreements. And we think we sort of won that, if you will. So ISDS is rollback is important and is in the new NAFTA. Other things are, you know, this is an agreement that has actually impressive language on demanding free and independent labor power in Mexico. As it stands, Mexican workers are sort of under the thumb of fake unions, are under the thumb of what are called protection contracts. A Mexican worker often doesn't know that they're actually in a union when they go and work at, say, some factory. And these unions are perfectly in line with their employer's interest. This new agreement, on paper, it says that Mexican workers will have the ability to call those so-called unions to election, and if they're not, be replaced by independent unions. This is something that labor long wanted to try to stop the race to the bottom. What is attractive about Mexico for so-called investors? What's attractive about Mexico for manufacturers that causes them to move plants out of the U.S. into Mexico in the first place? It's working conditions and worker pay, and for Mexicans to be able to stand up and assert their rights over that is very, very important for folks on both sides of the border.
Some of the other elements that I know that organized labor is happy about, or likes in this new agreement sort of connect to this Trump's sort of economic nationalist America First stance, right? This, you know, this idea of the U.S. is sort of getting taken advantage of by the whole rest of the world and sort of bring jobs back home and playing to, you know, the deindustrialized sectors. I know there's some assurance that a higher percentage of automobiles will now be manufactured in higher wage settings and similar things. Say a little bit more about what this does for labor rights and how we should understand that.
Yeah, you've raised the other quite interesting point that the new NAFTA has a wage floor for a certain sector. It has a wage floor, meaning that in the auto sector, if you're going to produce a so-called NAFTA car, if you're going to produce a car that carries the benefits of its, you know, tariff-free status being from the NAFTA region, then 40% of its value has to be produced by workers making 16 or more an hour. So that either dictates a rapid rise in Mexican auto worker wages, or it maybe you'd say in the meanwhile it supports what are higher paying jobs in the United States and in Canada and kind of, in a sense, protects them. So, I mean, perspectives like ours would say that wage floors should be cross-sectoral. What's the principle behind a wage floor in a trade agreement? That people who do the work that the gains of the economy flow from ought to be able to have living wages, ought to be adequately compensated for contributing to things that we all benefit by. So the fact that it's kind of confined to the auto sector is a head scratcher, but no, that's a gain for it's a gain for labor.
How does corporate America view this new NAFTA agreement? Who wins? Who loses? Are there sectors of industry that are coming out better off in this agreement than others? Talk about some of that, some of how that plays out.
Yeah, and I think as I answer that, maybe I'll come around to answering sort of what really outweighs those apparently great things about the new NAFTA, right? Because like I'm saying, you know, organizations like ours are not impressed with the new NAFTA. Organized labor in particular is saying, hey, to our allies in Congress, what are you going to do to make this agreement better still? And so across the coalition of Oregon Fair Trade Campaign and of our partner groups, across these coalitions in the movement of movements that makes up trade justice, labor is saying it's not good enough. Environmental groups are saying it continues environmental damage. Climate justice groups are saying it's not good enough, and on and on. And so I think it does fall back to those sort of traditional lines of civil society saying this is a bad trade model and big business saying this is the only way we can do it, folks. Because to answer your question, the corporate interests have got enough of what they wanted out of this agreement to have come out championing it, to come out saying that we're going to push for its passage as soon as it's taken up by the legislatures. So yeah, if there's a corporate loser, if you will, well, the auto industry, because of some of the very things that we've already talked about, like increased auto rules of origin and a wage floor for auto workers. So the auto industry finds this agreement tolerable, but they have groaned of some of the apparent hits that they feel they're going to take if this were to become the new norm. But every other big business sector that you can think of has spoken only very favorably of this agreement. Oil and gas wins very, very big in the new NAFTA, alarmingly. In fact, there's an article on oilprice.com if you care to go there. And the headline of the article on oilprice.com is "Oil Majors Win Big in New NAFTA Deal." And this is an industry article for its own sector, right? And there's a subheading in the article which says, "Many wins, the environment loses."
There are other sectors as well that seem to do quite well. Talk a little bit about how it benefits big pharma, big ag and food, banking and financial services.
Yeah, those are on my list. Those are definitely sectors that come away very pleased with this new NAFTA. Pharmaceutical companies, which are at least the global sort of trade dynamics around pharmaceuticals, is that U.S. pharma kind of pushes the rest of the world to be heavy on biologic patents. And this has a really, really aggressive 10-year patent for new biologics, meaning that certain life-saving medicines can only be in the hands of their corporate originator instead of generics, meaning that a lot of folks will not have access to affordable medicine across the border. So a big pharma is pleased, and copyright interests across the board are pleased. And that extends to the finance industry, that extends to the tech industries, from software to digital trade to like web giants like Amazon and Facebook. Their lobbying was successful as far as getting a hearing with the Trump people to get their interests fit into this new NAFTA.
And then dairy is a big one. I know that Canada had to give a lot and allow its protected and regulated dairy market to have a lot more U.S. produced cheese and milk coming in.
Yeah, the agribusiness interests that are aligned with mega dairies, or the agribusiness interests that represent mega dairies, wanted to be able to treat Canada as a market, as an export ground, to sort of satisfy what is truly a dairy crisis in our country. However, family farm groups, small farm groups, have said, look, you can't export your way out of a volatile ag market. Exports are not the answer, or not the only answer. So the ag interests that we think stand up for regular folks, that we think stand up for other people than just corporate ag, are saying that, hey, that kind of interruption of Canada's dairy norm was not good policy nationally or internationally.
My guest is Russell Lum. He is the Trade Justice Coordinator of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, and we're talking about the renegotiated NAFTA 2.0. Let's very, very briefly talk about Mexico and the political context in Mexico. Mexicans in July elected a new left-leaning president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He has been very critical of NAFTA, and particularly agriculture being included in NAFTA. And yet, AMLO, his initials, his incoming government, which is not in yet, did not really get involved in these negotiations, sort of kept hands off. How do we make sense of the incoming left government in Mexico and its stance on this renegotiation of NAFTA?
Yeah, well, to say that AMLO's incoming folks were hands off is actually kind of a generous way of putting it. AMLO's incoming administration actually tried to hurry this agreement along and tried to work towards its completion so that basically the AMLO administration wouldn't be the one on the hook to actually sign it, wouldn't be the one on the hook to actually have said that we negotiated this. So we're not pleased. We're not pleased with AMLO's position. I mean, after decades of being critical of neoliberalism, he has certainly changed civil society's view of himself and undercut some of his own programs with this new favorability to NAFTA.
Before we wrap up, what do you expect to happen when NAFTA comes before Congress? Only have about 30 seconds. What should we expect to come next?
Oh, it could go so many different ways. And we're speaking just very, very close to Election Day, so we don't know what Congress's priorities towards NAFTA will be. But it could be a matter of getting, say, Democrats, say, Labor's allies in Congress to throw down and say, you know what, drastically make this a transformative agreement, or be oppositional towards this agreement.
Well, I've been speaking with Russell Lum, the Trade Justice Coordinator for the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. Thank you so much, Russell, and appreciate having you here on The Old Mole.
Absolutely. Glad to have been here.
Ministers meet, work on the movement of goods. Also work on the movement of capital. Also work on the movement of human beings. As if we were so many cattle. Grim travelers in dawn sky.